Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection, was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. In her new book, Growing Up in Public, author and speaker Dr. Devorah Heitner tackles the questions all parents want to know about technology and their children, packed with real stories and insights from her work and interviews with tweens, teens, and parents. Growing Up in Public is on the short list of books that I will consistently recommend to anyone who has children. On today's program, Dr. Heitner is joining me to discuss one of my favorite topics, teens, technology, and the impact that social media is having on our children's developing minds. Thank you, Dr. Heitner, for taking the time to join us today on Line One.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I guess let's, as I said, I really love this this subject. It's one that it's been important to me for a long, long time. And so I want to get into your book has sort of made me question, I think, some of the maybe overreactions that we have had as a parenting community and as therapists to this storm of social media and technology. And it's been really hard to keep up with. But before we get started here, I need to take a second to remind listeners that today's episode of Line One was pre-recorded, and we will not be able to accept listener phone calls or emails. So just sit back and enjoy, because there's a lot of information in this book, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts, Dr. Heitner, and getting into some of the meat of this. But let's start off by having you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and what work you've been doing and what kind of led you to study this area.
So I've been researching and writing about kids and the digital age for a long time. And I used to teach a college class called Kids Media Culture. And I had my 18 to 22 year old college students out interviewing third graders about their media. And that's when I started noticing micro generations where, you know, an 18-year-old could have a sibling that's a third grader, potentially, you know, that's not a full generation apart, but there were already so many differences between what my 18-year-olds were experiencing and what the 9-year-olds were experiencing when I started doing that, teaching that class in 2012. It just got me interested. And even when I had my own son in 2009, and my friends were kind of asking these questions, like, should we be sharing our babies on Facebook, right? Like so many of my peers just had all these questions about what we should be doing, what should we let our kids play with, the emerging technologies like tablets, which of course now is like a foregone conclusion that kids are using tablets. And I just got really curious about what I saw as a moral panic that, as a media historian, we've seen this before where people thought comic books were going to turn kids, you know, into, you know, monsters, or that the movies were going to be very problematic. There was the same kind of worry about social media and touch screens. And as I began to research the topic and look at what was actually out there for parents, I recognized that there was a real hole in the information market for parents. There were sort of people saying, don't do screens, but there was nothing to say how to do screens. There was nothing for parents to say, well, what if you do want your kid to be able to participate in digital communities? How do you mentor them? How do you teach them how to do it? Because abstinence is not really a realistic solution for most families, I think, in relation to digital connection.
All right. Well, that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading the book, is it's a little bit different, and it's broken down into different sections. And each one of them, I will tell you, is something that I have heard in my office over and over again from parents. And, you know, and consistently from teenagers telling the parents to back off. It's not that big of a deal. But your approach is, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about why the book is set up the way it is and what somebody would expect if they were to pick this? Because there's a lot of stuff out there. We are inundated with many, many books and podcasts and, you know, specials about social media and movies. What's different about yours, or what could somebody expect when they pick up your book?
Well, I am tremendously empathetic to teenagers. This is not a book about what's wrong with kids today. I'm actually interested in understanding how are kids changing the culture, right? So when adults say, oh, kids will share anything, I'm like, well, actually, kids have a lot to say about privacy and boundaries, but their perspective on it might be different than ours. So I'm really trying to break down that generational divide and try to help adults have empathy for what is it like growing up with Snapchat, which has this map that shows you where all your friends are.
Yeah.
And what feelings does that engender in kids? And so it's helpful to just take a step back and say, how is my kid experiencing this? If my kid wants to use a tool like Discord or join a community like Roblox, you know, what does that even mean, rather than just fear it because it's unfamiliar? So I think a lot of what I'm trying to do is reassure parents, help parents find empathy for their kids, help other caregivers like teachers and other people have kids in their lives to understand what are kids going through? What are the digital milestones of growing up today? And how can we mentor kids so that it's a little bit less perilous, you know, so that it can go better?
Yeah, those are great points, because we're not, it doesn't feel like we're going to be able to get this genie back in the bottle. I mean, I know there are some countries over in Europe that are taking the, you know, the 15 or 16 year old approach for cell phones and trying to legislate it a little bit. Have there been any movements in that direction here? Because we're not going to, the kids kind of got ahead of us on this, I think. We all thought it was a great idea to be able to connect with our kids whenever we wanted. And, you know, you got to be careful what you wish for, because it's opened up a whole other can of worms. But what are you hearing recently from the, you know, from that end of trying to put more regulations on cell phones and kids?
Well, we're seeing a lot of states feel frustrated, I think, with Meta, TikTok, Snapchat, and these big companies. So you're seeing states signing onto a lawsuit against Meta. You're right. Also seeing states try to pass parental controls. I think some of the parental control ideas, I understand, and I'm empathetic to parents who feel like their kids have experienced harm in these spaces, but I think parental controls are problematic on a social media perspective, especially I wrote in my Substack about why the Utah law, for example, which is one of the more aggressive laws, I'll say, that passed for 2024. Yeah. Kids are supposed to be 18 before they get on social media, or their parents are supposed to control their accounts before they're 18. And one of the points I made in my Substack was, if you're going to allow 16-year-olds to drive, I think saying that 18 is the age for Instagram is problematic, because I think driving is a bigger responsibility and has more potential for harm to yourself or others. Not that you can't ever do harm on, you know, Instagram or another social account, but I just think we have to be realistic about helping kids become part of digital communities, because they're going to need to be on Slack and on LinkedIn and all these spaces for work and life. And so keeping kids completely off digital communities or allowing their parents too much control, it also puts kids in danger if their parents are abusive or invasive or trying to, you know, control their identities. And I think especially about LGBTQ plus kids and how potentially if their parents aren't supportive, social media can be an important outlet that we don't want to take away from those kids. So I just think it's problematic to just say, oh, parents need to control it. It also assumes all kids have parents and that all kids have parents who are looking out for them, and right. Not all kids have parents, and not all kids have parents who are supportive and great. Of course, if kid does, you know, if they're lucky and they have supportive and wonderful parents, yeah, it would be great for those parents to mentor them on social media, get them a phone and sit down with them and look at it with them, talk to them about who they should be in contact with. But does that mean a kid growing up in the foster care system just should never have access to social media? You know, it just doesn't seem like a very well thought out set of rules. I would like to see the companies that make these apps get a lot more responsive, especially if there are complaints about bullying and other things. They just need to have a much more robust staff. And right now the profit models are structured differently, and you don't see them putting all their efforts into making the user experience a positive one and keeping kids safe.
Yeah, there's all sorts of interesting questions around that industry and how similar it is to cigarettes and, you know, some of those things that companies were taking advantage of and targeting children. But so it's an interesting approach. But your book really takes it from the other angle and lets build skills and build the ability to know what's coming, because this stuff is so significant and powerful in teenagers' lives. I mean, I tried to restrict a lot of the access to that stuff with my kids, and just the way that it evolved and their friend group and the social connections. And it was really isolating for them. And maybe, I mean, it kind of feels like we're dinosaurs trying to, or mammals trying to explain dinosaurs, or maybe it's dinosaurs trying to explain mammals, whoever came first, but you get my point. Like, we just don't really understand what this is like to grow up in this age. And so, like, what are the, you talk a lot about mentoring over monitoring. Can you discuss that idea and give us a little bit? And we'll do that right after I just reconnect real quick. So if you're tuning in late today, my guest is author Devra Heitner, who is joining us to discuss her new book, Growing Up in Public. Please note that today's conversation was pre-recorded and we are not able to accept phone calls. All right, Dr. Heitner, so mentoring over monitoring, what does that mean and how is it applied in your thinking?
Well, when we mentor kids, we're actually talking with them about their experience. We're asking them for their discernment. We're sharing with them potentially mistakes we've made or helping them recover and repair from mistakes. Like if they've hurt a friend's feelings on Minecraft or Roblox or on the group text, or if somebody got upset with them for a comment they made, or if we've shared an image of our kids without permission and they get mad at us, all of those are opportunities for mentoring and conversation. Whereas monitoring is really about catching our kids kind of doing the wrong mm-hmm. thing or coloring outside the lines, doing something we don't want them to do. Mentoring is about teaching them how to do the right thing and how to repair if we've messed up, including sometimes telling them about ways we've had to repair. You know, maybe you sent an email and didn't BCC, or you wrote something in haste that really offended somebody, and or you know, you recognize like, oh, it would have been better to pick up the phone in this case because I was getting into a conflict. These are all scenarios where we have the opportunity to mentor our kids about texting, about social media. And if we only monitor, we're, you know, again, catching them sort of after the fact when it's, you know, too late to change what they're doing in the moment. Obviously, you can still repair, but also they're going to have the sense of, oh, I'm in trouble for this, and they may want to hide from you. And the problem with that is that our kids need us, and able to be safe in a digital environment. Our kids need to be able to tell us if something's gone wrong, or if someone's sent them a creepy direct message, or if they've shared something that they wish they hadn't shared. And it's really important that we are available to them. And if they're worried about getting caught, they're going to be more focused on going underground and not sharing with us. They're going to be hiding from us, and we don't want that.
No, because communication, I think, is the key in any of this parenting. No matter what the issue, what the conversation is, it's getting your kids to open up and talk, and sometimes that can be very, very hard. So you've been doing this research for a long time and talking to parents and children or parents and children of all ages. And what are the biggest concerns or the issues that are raised in your research? What are you finding are the biggest struggles for parents to navigate?
Parents worry a lot about kids getting canceled for posting the wrong thing, for saying something or being videoed or photographed doing something really inappropriate. Parents worry about kids sending naked pictures and, you know, nudes, that kind of thing, sexting. Parents are also worried about kids' level of stress, their self-esteem, you know, because they can see the number of followers they have, like on a lot of apps like Instagram, for example, or YouTube or TikTok. You can see how many people follow. You can see the likes on Snapchat. You can see a map where all your friends are. Obviously, any of those things could make you feel terrible. And then sometimes the algorithm on top of all of that will send you images or videos that are really problematic, or, you know, content that will make you feel bad about yourself or contribute to worries that you might already have about yourself. So it's very understandable why parents are concerned. I think we need to look at our actual kid. You know, do you have a kid who is impulsive and might send a nude? Do you have a kid who gets into conflicts really easily with other people, and they need conflict resolution skills, ideally, you know, before they're getting on the group text? You have to look at your own individual child and really see, like, where are they potentially struggling? Where are they? What are their strengths? Sometimes a strength, like, you know, maybe a kid who makes friends really easily is also going to be a challenge, because that's a kid who's going to want to have a lot of social media connections, maybe at an age where they're not ready for that. So I would also look at you know, how can I help my super social kid, for example, to recognize that you don't have to be connected with everyone on social media, and especially at a young age, or recognize that the social labor of having to like everyone's photos is not something, or they don't have to be available all the time. For an introverted or a shyer kid, maybe the challenge is teaching them, how do you connect with someone if they're kind of nervous to do it, but they want to see somebody like outside of school? How do you, you know, get their contact information? All of that is a challenge. And every single issue I've mentioned is just something that, you know, every family might face. Like, you might have one super social kid who right. you're trying to unplug them at night. You might have one shy kid who they can't figure out how to join the Discord. And our kids need our help, but they need us to see them. You know, you don't need to, for example, if you have a first grader, your worry shouldn't probably be about, you know, sexting and Snapchat. You want to be helping them navigate Roblox. So you also want to kind of be with your kid where they are and not get too far ahead of yourself as a caregiver, because it's a quickly changing environment. So when I'm speaking at school, sometimes I'll have very kind of eager parents of preschoolers listening to some of the things I'm saying about teenagers. And I'm like, yes, attend to this now, but also know that you have a four-year-old now. So what, the most important thing you can do with your four-year-old is model thoughtful use of your own phone. Put it away when you're driving, put it away when you're eating. You know, don't sleep with your phone if you don't want your four-year-old to think that's what the grown-ups do.
Right. That's where modeling is so important. You talk a lot about modeling as well. I can tell you, like, the one issue that has come up that has been consistently on parents' minds, and especially for those with daughters for some reason, is the sexting and the nudes. And, you know, this whole idea of dating and flirting online, it's this new sort of medium. I mean, a lot of your stories were really interesting in the fact that all of us adults, and I haven't talked to any adult in my practice or among my friend group that isn't really, really happy that we didn't have this technology when we were growing up.
Absolutely. And we absolutely would have used it. I mean, I had friends who worked at a photo place in a college neighborhood in Boston, and tons of people brought nudes. They just didn't come back for them. You know, they would like bring them in when they were drunk or in the heat of the moment, thinking this is like an awesome idea. And then they wouldn't return for them often. And some of them ended up, you know, going home with the people who worked there, I have to tell you, which is not great to think about. But at least it wasn't easy to distribute them and share them. I mean, that's the thing, that it's not just that kids are taking nudes, it's that they can get out there and then be out there because of digital sharing and resharing that makes it so scary. If we knew that it was limited, like if your kid gave somebody a Polaroid and it couldn't be easily distributed, I don't think it would feel as nerve-wracking.
No, maybe 10 people see it, or the Photoshop people show it to the other Photoshop people. And the kid didn't want to go back and pick it up because they were embarrassed that those people just looked at the pictures, right? Or whatever it is.
Exactly, exactly. So we definitely need to talk to kids of all genders about it, you know, whether they're our sons or daughters, our kids who identify as non-binary. It's really important because, you know, and there are some very gendered dynamics that I get into the book, in the book, including, you know, boys kind of bugging girls and harassing girls for pictures. Yeah. And it's very important to talk to, again, all kids about never coercing someone. But I think that's a conversation I would lean into with boys and make sure that they know they should never coerce or harass a girl into sending a picture. And if they do have a picture that was shared consensually, they should never reshare it. Or, you know, if the relationship ends, they should get rid of it. Our kids need to know, of course, in Alaska and all states, it's illegal to have images on your phone or your device of somebody underage, including yourself, which is a weird situation. Right. That it's called self-production in the legal term, self-production of child pornography, that is. But obviously, you know, you hope that like a topless picture a 15-year-old takes of herself that's on her own phone isn't going to send her to jail as a child pornographer, because that's really messed up, right? I think we can all agree that that's not the intent of the law. But we live in a world that's messed up. So we have to kind of teach our kids, yes, these laws are messed up, but also don't break them and don't get caught breaking them. Like, you know, if you have a nude of somebody, don't keep it around. I share a lot of ideas in the book, mostly from some researchers, Justin Patchen and Samir Hinduja, who talked about safer sexting, which I think makes a lot of adults really nervous because mm-hmm. we don't want to seem like we're condoning sending nudes. But you could say to your kid, look, I'm worried about the social privacy and legal risk of sending nudes. So I would, you know, prefer you not do it. But if you do it in the context of a relationship, these are some ways you can stay safer, like not having your face in the picture, not having other identifiable things in the picture, right. making it a picture that's sexy rather than sexual in the sense of maybe implications, but without actually being, you know, showing body parts that could get you in trouble. Most people do not want to have that conversation with their kids. It's a pretty awkward conversation. So I think also just sticking to keep your own integrity, never make someone else feel unsafe. If an image is going around school, never be part of shaming that person, sharing that image. You don't want to be part of violating someone's privacy and making someone unsafe. I think that's a really important message because a lot of kids won't send an image themselves, but an image will go around at school and they sort of won't know what to do with it. And they might forward it because they just feel so uncomfortable. So I think, or they might laugh about someone. We need to make sure that kids aren't engaged in a double standard and judging girls who share their images in a different way than we judge boys. Neither kids of either gender nor, again, non-binary kids should be sharing pictures of themselves unbidden. So like some kids will do it as a way to flirt. One thing I've said, especially to boys, is girls don't like this as a way of flirting. Like if a boy is sending pictures of his genitals as a way to flirt, this was universally, like girls told me, like even boys that they previously thought of as like a maybe, or maybe I would go out with this person, or if I, you know, they're funny and cute, a picture like that is a turn off, not a turn on. And especially as a way to get to know someone, right? It's like, no, I didn't ask for that. Thank you. Or no, thank you, I should say. Right. And I think that's really important. And then I also leaned into the research about what LGBTQ plus kids are doing in this department, because I think we so often focus on the boy-girl dynamics, but what about boys who like boys or girls who like girls or kids who identify in other ways, right? I think it's important to think about the dynamics for those kids. And one of the things I learned from the research is that all kids, you know, straight or LGBTQ plus kids are potentially sharing images like this as a way of getting validation of their attractiveness.
Yeah.
As a way of someone saying, oh, you're so hot or you're so cute or whatever. And as parents, we're like, we don't really want to see our kids that way. Like, you know, I don't think any of us want to see our kids as like sexually attractive. We might notice that they're adorable. Or, oh, they're growing up, right? But like, you don't want to see them that way. And so it's weird to think about that. But I think it's an important thing to understand as an adult that, oh, this is a reason my kid might do this. It might be because they're in a love relationship and this is something they've decided to do together to express their intimacy and closeness. Or it might be really exciting. Or it might be a way to try to, you know, feel cute. And I think especially for the queer kids, that the lack of kind of attractiveness validation from just heteronormative culture in most high schools is a reason that they might go towards something like this. And again, it's not that every kid is doing this. 10 to 20% of kids are sharing pictures like this. And that means 80% are not, right? So the good news is your kid probably isn't. There's a good chance that your kid is not going to share a nude, whether it's with someone they're in a relationship with, a boyfriend or girlfriend, or someone they're flirting with. But they're almost certainly going to hear about a friend who's done it. And kids are safer if they have an adult they can talk to. So maybe it's not your kid who shares an image, but their friend. And if their friend's image is then being used against their will or being shared beyond the initial audience, their friend needs to be able to go to the school counselor or go to a parent or go to an adult to get help, whether that's legal help, whether that's a restraining order, whether that's getting out of the class with the kid who's sharing their image without consent.
Right.
It's so important that that kid has help, because the kids who feel alone and shamed, which is what can happen if we lean into the shame-based messaging around sexting and we don't talk about remedies and we don't say that all of us are worthy of respect. Even if you've shared a nude, you're still worthy of respect. You still deserve your privacy. You shouldn't be disrespected. Then those are the kids that are the most vulnerable. And this is what I heard from an attorney that Carrie Goldman, who I interviewed for the book, who talked about kids whose images are shared, you know, against their will, the revenge porn kinds of situations. And that situation leaves a kid very dangerous. Carrie Goldberg, she is an incredible resource on this topic, and hopefully you'll never need her, right? Like, nobody wants to be calling someone who specializes in revenge pornography. But she and other attorneys who work on this have created resources to help. And a lot of their clients are, you know, 12, 13. I thought of this as something that adults would be going to her for, but she said, no, there are families coming to her. You know, my 12-year-old shared an image and now somebody's threatening her and stalking her, right? So these are very scary situations, and they do happen to boys as well. And kids need, the kids who are the most vulnerable, according to Carrie Goldberg, are the kids who can't tell an adult,
right,
who don't have an adult in their corner, who fear punishment more than they, you know, think that an adult would be on their side. And so the message to kids about sexting needs to be something like, you know, there's a lot of risks. I kind of hope you won't do it. If you do, and you're in a jam, please come talk to me. I'll always be on your side. I'll always be here for you.
Right. All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest is author Deborah Heitner, who is joining us to discuss her new book, Growing Up in Public. Please note that today's conversation was pre-recorded and we are not able to accept phone calls or emails. After a short break, we'll return for more of our conversation with Dr. Deborah Heitner. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest is author and researcher Deborah Heitner, who is joining us to discuss her new book, Growing Up in Public. Please note that today's conversation was pre-recorded and we will not be able to accept phone calls or emails today. So just sit back and listen. All right, Dr. Heitner, it's been quite a journey to get here. We're continuing our conversation after a break, but I wanted to get back into something that we were just talking about before the break, and that is this idea of, you mentioned the sexting is one of the biggest fears that many parents have, and one of the chapters in your book is about what to do if that happens. So can you talk about, because I've had several examples in my office of kids who have gotten what you called in your book canceled because of some pictures, some inappropriate pictures that got passed around and blown up. So what do parents and kids do when this happens? Because it's one of the biggest ones out there.
We certainly want to encourage our kids not to be part of canceling another kid, and instead to view a child or teenager who has had their image shared non-consensually as someone whose rights to privacy and safety have been violated. So we need to actually rally around that person and support them rather than judge them for trusting someone who maybe wasn't worthy of their trust. So that's a big shift that communities and families need to make. And if we hear our kids shaming or talking negatively about another child or teenager, we want to intervene because we don't want to be part of that community onslaught that's making someone who's already been violated feel worse and more vulnerable. Another thing we need to do is make sure that kids are safe at school. So if the school knows that this has happened and they know who did it, you know, they may be able to change somebody's schedule to give them some space. We need to impress upon kids how serious it is to share someone's image without consent. At the same time, you know, I do think the legal situation needs to be different for children versus adults because kids really don't understand sometimes how serious this is. So, you know, I'm not saying I want to live in a world where middle schoolers are going to jail for sharing somebody's picture. I do want to live in a world where it's safer for everyone, where that doesn't happen as much, where every kid understands that that's a really big deal and a really big violation of someone's privacy and safety. And if this happens to your kid or one of their friends that they care about, we really want to communicate that we still respect them and we understand that sometimes, you know, something can seem like a good idea in the moment. And we've all done things that seem like a good idea in the moment that turn out to have not been a safe choice. And that doesn't mean we're not worthy of respect and protection.
Yeah. And there's two angles to look at it from. One is the child whose picture gets shared or whose image or video gets passed around the school. That's one thing for parents to deal with. And then the other one is, what if it's your kid who's doing the sharing? How do you approach that with them?
I would definitely be very concerned if my child had shared someone's picture, you know, or, you know, their own picture or someone else's picture without consent.
And it's very important that they understand that that is a harmful choice and that they need to do everything they can to, you can't get it back, right? If you've shared it with others, but if you posted it, you could take it down, right? You could acknowledge the harm you've caused and work, I think in this case with adults or a school counselor to kind of make restitution. That person might not want contact with you and you would have to respect that. And to recognize that, you know, in the most extreme cases, you actually might need legal advice about how to move forward. And if that was my kid, I would definitely get legal advice about how to keep my kid safe from, you know, the most extreme consequences and make sure that anyone who was dealing with them treated them like a kid or a teenager and someone who is learning. And then ultimately, ask yourself, what's going on with my kid? Like, is your child needing, feeling like they need attention? Did they do it for notoriety? Was their vision something about revenge? Like, what was this about for them? And they probably need some counseling and support around whatever issue motivated them to share these images without someone's consent.
Yeah, because that's, it's a big deal. And, you know, as a parent, it's almost worse if your kid is the bully versus if they're being bullied. It feels.
And I think it's harder for parents to imagine, for any of us, that our kid could perpetrate harm on someone else. Absolutely.
Yeah, not little Johnny. We really want to, but you made a really good point that these are all kids. These are 15, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and they're doing stuff that is on par for the adolescent mind. It's impulsive, right? It's
or 11, 12, 13. I talked to a lot of cases that were middle school cases. So like, and I do think, frankly, you know, barring any sort of developmental disability, you know, we can have higher expectations for a 17-year-old who knows they've caused harm than a 12-year-old. Like there's a big difference between 12, 13 and 16, 17. You know, are 17-year-olds still adolescents and impulsive? Absolutely. But you have a pretty good idea of how much harm you're causing when you're 17. And I think that's a kid, you know, that may need a different kind of consequence than a 12-year-old. You know, it really does depend on the situation, how I would move forward. But absolutely, if that's your kid, I wouldn't just be defensive. I would also be focused on how can I help my kid really learn to do better. But at the same time, be protected from a shame spiral that might potentially lead to them thinking I'm going to take my life or something, right? We don't want kids to feel like there's no way to move forward, even if they've really messed up.
I'm really glad you brought that up because that can happen on both sides of this equation, right? A kid can go into that, what you call a shame spiral. And you have a whole section in the book of the difference between shame versus guilt. Can you talk a little bit about that and the damage that the shame-based kind of parenting can do?
Absolutely. I mean, shame is really when you feel like you yourself can't recover, that there's a stain sort of on you, whereas guilt is about your actions and can provoke you, I think, and we've seen this from the research, to do better next time, to, you know, if I feel guilty about my relative privilege, maybe I can help others. Like, there's a way that guilt can be motivating and shame can actually be demotivating. It can make us feel like, you know, we are a terrible person. It's not just our action that was bad, but truly like there's no redeeming this, you know, and that becomes then a problem because it doesn't lead to action that is positive for me or for others. Whereas if I feel guilty, I can remediate that and I can do better next time. I can repair, et cetera.
Yeah, that's shame is, as you mentioned, and you mentioned Brené Brown's work, and she does a lot of really good work around shame versus guilt. And yeah, as you mentioned, guilt is something that is repairable. It's something I did that was hurtful, but I am not necessarily bad or unworthy. And that's one of the challenges that we run into. A lot of parents, you know, if you, you know, publicly make your child, you know, apologize or do some thing that is not repairing, but it's more about scare tactics or, you know, putting fear into your child. That has a sort of a backfire result, correct?
Yeah, we want to see kids privately apologize. And there may be a place for some kind of public statement, you know, if your kid has been in the news. Mm-hmm. But that's a situation where I'd parse really carefully. But if your kid has harmed someone individually, you know, going to their home to apologize or finding a way that they that other person can feel safe and apologize in person. And again, if that person doesn't want to see your kid, then that's different. You don't want to violate a restraining order. But if there's a situation where you could make it better, you can go to them and apologize. And that's a very real thing to do. But kids have to understand the harm they've caused and why they're apologizing. They shouldn't do it just because they were forced to. I think that's the problem with sometimes when schools move too fast with that kind of discipline. Like, we really need to do restorative work, but you can't just say, oh, I'm sorry. That's not restorative.
What should parents know? I mean, I know each state has different laws, but what are the current, do you know any of the recent updates or laws to sexting or child pornography when it's the child?
Sexting is a very dicey territory in all states. You know, I don't know the exact laws in Alaska, but I do know that in most states, kids are vulnerable if they share their own image and they have an image even of themselves. We've heard of situations where kids take an image of themselves because they're just trying to understand how their own body looks, or they're literally just like recording the changes of puberty,
right?
And they have these devices with them, and then that's considered self-production of child pornography. And obviously, if they're doing it because they were exploited by an adult, that adult should pay, you know, a legal penalty. And I have no objection to that.
Correct.
Right? Adults,
yeah,
shouldn't exploit children. But if they shared it with a friend, if they shared it with, you know, a same age peer, or if they kept it private, the idea that we're penalizing them, you know, becomes unnecessarily punitive. So I think the laws have to catch up with what kids can do with these phones. I don't think any of us want to see, you know, a 14-year-old girl who takes a picture in the dressing room of herself to look at for herself later for whatever reasons, whether or not that's healthy or not. I don't think we want to make her a criminal, right? Or a boy, right?
Right.
At the same time, if that kid is then sharing that image unbidden with someone else, that becomes a problem because that's harassment. Sexting is just really tricky. I mean, we obviously don't want our kids doing it, but we really need to emphasize staying safer. And if kids are going to share images with someone they like or have a crush on or they're dating, ideally they're doing it in a less dangerous way, which would be maybe their face isn't attached to the image, that's less identifiable. Other things, as I wrote about in Growing Up in Public, you know, and I'm citing Justin Patchen and Samir Hindush's research on this. And then we also need to, you know, allow for the fact that most kids won't do this, but they still might be bystanders. And if somebody's airdropping the whole cafeteria a picture, your kid needs to just know, don't share it, don't look at it.
Right. Let's move away from sexting for a minute. And the other big one that I hear about is cyberbullying, online bullying. That's a tricky landscape to navigate because the initial reaction of parents is like, let's go in, let's talk to the school. I mean, what is the correct approach for parents on this? Because your kids, of course, are going to say, don't do that. It's just going to get worse. The school's not going to do anything, right? They don't stop it. How should or how could parents address this if it's coming up in their child or for their child?
If your child is experiencing a negative interaction online, I would have a lot of questions for them about, like, where is it happening? Is it happening on a group text? Could you just leave the group text? If somebody's texting you, can you change your phone number or block that person? You know, is there a way to cut off contact if it's a very identifiable situation? Now, if it's anonymous, if it's happening in a number of apps, then that becomes more tricky because most kids won't accept being cut offline. And they'll feel like they're being punished, right, even though they're the victim or the target. So it gets really challenging, but as much as you can, without invading your child's privacy completely, let them know that in order to keep them safe, you want to be interceding some of this. Like, if they're getting hateful comments on a YouTube channel, can they turn off the comments? Like, there are ways sometimes to use tech to block people's access to you. If there's an app where things are really negative, maybe getting off of that app for at least a short while, maybe eventually starting a new account in that app where you can't be found by the targets. Or if the target, you know, if the bullies do go to school with you and you can identify them, certainly you can go to school. I understand and empathize with kids who feel like that could make it worse. it's also complicated because a lot of times kids will say they're being bullied, and maybe in some ways they are, but they're also experiencing more mutual aggression, and they may play a role in what's going on.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a party that's at greater fault or at greater risk, but it becomes tricky because kids don't want to report sometimes because maybe they've said something that's documented that isn't so great. So it's really challenging. I don't have easy answers, but yeah. I do think if you engage with reading about this, I know not just in my book and Growing Up in Public, but there's a great book, Behind Their Screens. There's other research by Justin Patchen and Samir Hinduja about cyberbullying. And schools ultimately need to be teaching kids social skills, even on the playground, that will help kids deflect minor aggression so it doesn't always turn into a massive conflict. So much of what our kids need is help navigating minor conflicts so they don't turn into major conflicts, understanding what's a positive versus a toxic friendship, understanding, you know, how to back off from a situation that is dangerous or problematic, and what to report, including what they witness. A lot of times kids aren't being directly bullied, but they might see something in a group text or on social media that's problematic, and it may be something that they should report.
Yeah, kids, you see those situations where cell phone recordings of fights or something happen, and it starts spreading around like wildfire. It's very impulsive, and it's important to talk to your kids about this stuff before they get into those situations, which is kind of what I want to tackle in our last section here after we come back from a break is how should parents introduce this stuff? And really also I want to talk and visit, when is it okay to snoop, or is it ever okay to snoop on your kids' devices? So we will get into those questions after we take this short break. If you're just tuning in, my guest is author and researcher Devorah Heitner, who is joining us to discuss her newest book, Growing Up in Public. Please note that today's conversation was pre-recorded, and we are not able to accept phone calls or emails. After this short break, we'll continue with more of our conversation with Dr. Devorah Heitner. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection was pre-recorded. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during the show.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who are tuning in late, my guest is author and researcher Devorah Heitner, who is joining us to discuss her new book, Growing Up in Public, which I would strongly recommend to any parents or people who have young children. I don't think it's ever too early to start talking about this, because the reach of these devices and of social media seems to be creeping down lower and lower in the age bracket. So please note that today's conversation was pre-recorded, and we will not be accepting phone calls or emails today. Okay, Dr. Heitner, I mentioned, it's hard to figure out when to give kids these devices and how to introduce them. But I do know that starting out slow and building up seems to be the best approach. But do you have are there any ground rules or any sort of, measures parents can take that as they introduce these devices? Or because I see kids on iPads at 2-3 years old, and that's sort of where they get hooked. So what's the research, and what are you learning about how to introduce this stuff in a way that's healthy and positive?
Absolutely. So we want to be thinking about the digital milestones our kids are facing from the first time they play with our phone or device and come back with 1,000 selfies and videos, as a toddler, right? Which you see all the time, to when do they get on these server-based games like Roblox, and some of our kids are getting on there first, second, third grade. So sometimes parents are saying, oh, I'm waiting on getting my kid a phone, but their kid is playing server-based games with strangers like Minecraft or Roblox, which could be fine, but then you're not waiting on digital community. You're just doing it in a different way. So right. I think it's important not to just think about devices, but also if your kid is using your device or a family shared device like a laptop or a desktop computer, even to log on to a server and play games with whoever, then that's a milestone. We need to teach them how to relate, just like we teach them how to relate on the playground. Then you want to think about content. What kind of content are they seeing, especially on things like YouTube and TikTok, where there's, let's face it, a really wide range of content, some of which we might not want children to see, especially in preschool, elementary school age. But even as they get older, we need to have those tough, tough conversations about pornography and violence. Then as they get to be the age of texting, we want to teach them how to text safely. Who are they allowed to be in contact with? So the question of should we look at our kids' devices and what they're doing, it's really more about mentoring than monitoring. But, you know, with a second grader, maybe they're not allowed to get a new app without permission. So, you know, when I say mentoring is better than monitoring, I don't mean that we're just letting our kids do whatever. I mean, we're teaching them how to do things, and we're setting up a family culture of how tech is used in our home and away from home. You know, are we on our devices when we're driving or out at the restaurant? They're going to see that. So we need to really attend to what we're doing, leading by example, setting up a family policy around when we're using screens, what we're doing on screens, who we connect with, what times we're doing this, not doing it, I believe, at night or in the bedroom, especially, you know, for kids and even for adults. Should we be on our computers and tech in the bedroom at night? Probably not. It's not great for sleep hygiene. So just looking at all those things.
We're grown-ups, but we still need to sleep.
We need to sleep as much as our kids do.
So that old, like, well, I'm an adult and so I can do it, or I'm working, is one that I've heard a lot from parents when the kids are like, well, you're on your phone all the time. Well, I'm doing something productive, right? I'm adulting. I'm working.
Maybe you are, but are you looking, especially as so many of us are working from home nowadays, are you working, or are you, you know, for me, I find like, I get really cozy in my office, which is in my home. And sometimes I want to go sit in the living room and do my work. But then I find if it bleeds into family time, then I'm not really attending to work or my family very attentively.
Yeah, the old we can multitask thing is actually a myth, correct? I mean, your brain
has
to...
We want to have boundaries, and single task.
Yeah.
And teach our kids not to double screen, not to do, you know, and my kid will side-eye me like crazy if I sit down to watch TV with him and I'm looking at my phone. It's like, why are you double screening? Didn't you write in your book not to do that? I'm like, oh, yeah.
Side-eye, bombastic side-eye. That's the one I've heard.
Yeah.
And it's funny, all of our kids use the same language. No matter where they are, because it's so pervasive on social media. And I just watch, you know, my kids. And what you just mentioned is I'm impressed that you've gotten your child to side-eye you when you're looking at your screen, watching a movie. That's one of the big, you know, sort of quirks that I have with my kid. I'm like, why are you watching two things? How do you watch a movie and play on your phone? Can you just make rules around that? Or do you have a conversation with your children about how do we want to do family time? Because
rules.
I just find myself getting angry.
Yeah. I mean, we start out with the rules. I'm also, you know, when I had an elementary schooler and the TV was accessed through a clicker before he had as many of his own devices, we would keep the clicker like in dad's office, and my husband works from home. And then he had to like check in with dad before he grabbed the clicker. And it was like, oh, have you had a snack? Have you done your homework? Like, are you, you know, is this like, is it time to grab the clicker? Like, we're cool with some TV, but, you know, so I'm not above sort of physically controlling the devices in the house in some ways to just set habits. I just don't think that that's the whole answer. Like, I think if we get totally into just taking the devices and we don't teach kids how to self-regulate, we're kind of missing then when they go to college or, you know, work or the military or whatever, how will they self-regulate, right? We need to do both and. But I also think expecting a 7-year-old or even a 13-year-old to self-regulate around a tablet or a phone in their room overnight is like unrealistic. That's just too much. Like most of us will struggle to self-regulate, and a young adolescent or young child is probably not ready to self-regulate around such an incredibly attractive, interesting set of opportunities, like, oh, all of Netflix, all of YouTube, right? So I think we need to help our kids self-regulate, but we don't want to not set them up to learn how to do it themselves. And that's where mentoring over monitoring is a good long-term strategy.
I kind of think about the old, but there's got to be a point at which you shut it down and take it away. Is there ever a point as parents in which you would say this is not working and we need to take this away for a month, or we need to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think for us, because we have a single kid, it's less about that and more about like redirecting. But yeah, if you give your kid a game or something and it's just a disaster, or your kid gets on an app and is misusing it to harm others, 100%, you could take it away forever. You could just be like, you have shown you can't handle this. Or if you got them a device and it's causing a lot of problems, you can rethink the time they have access to it. Like if they keep getting in trouble at school for having it at school, well, maybe they don't bring it to school for a while.
All right. So it's really based on how well they are handling it is how much space and room they have to operate with it.
Yeah. And we need to scaffold them. Like if your kid isn't succeeding right with something, what can you do to set them up for success? If your kid needed help in the kitchen, maybe they just need a step stool. If your kid is struggling with maintaining attention at school and getting detentions because they're looking at their phone, you know, you could try blocking their phone during the day, or you try sending them to school without their phone.
Okay. So there, I mean, we do have some power. And
I really
like the angle that the book takes. It really is about teaching and preparing young responsible, you know, citizens to handle their social media as they would their lives. And I think kids get caught up in this idea that it's just social media, or it's just a picture, or it's just this. I would never say that, you know, in real life. Or to somebody's face. So I think it's important. The messages in your book are critical, and I would encourage parents to read them. Can you talk, just we're sort of running out of time here, but I do want to talk about your last chapter in the book, that sort of transitioning as kids become young adults. Can you talk a little bit about what's in that?
I have talked to so many families that were just gobsmacked by the fact that colleges don't automatically share grades and health info, you know, and that your kid's health information is no longer accessible to you, because we've been so connected to our kids' physical and mental health and their academic performance as they're going through elementary, middle, and high school. And so many of us are overchecking our kids' grades, which I talk about in the book, and that we need to maybe not check and use the grading portals as frequently because it can undermine trust. But certainly when they get to college and their privacy over 18 is protected by both FERPA education privacy laws and HIPAA, which is health privacy laws, those sets of laws can really surprise families. And in some families, it may make sense to make sure that there's a waiver. Like say your kid has a chronic health condition and they want your help managing it past 18, maybe they waive some HIPAA rights. But ultimately our job is, in the years leading up to 18, we're teaching them how to manage their health and their academic performance. You know, where I interviewed a doctor for the book who talked about, these are some things we need to teach kids. And if you have a very healthy kid, they may be seeing the doctor once or twice a year.
Right.
So between 14 and 18, that might be 4 to 6 visits. So those are 6 precious times to teach your kid. How do you ask the doctor questions? How do you advocate for your own healthcare when there's no one else in the room doing it for you? And that's really important, because when they get to college, if they have a health issue or if they have a grade issue, it's going to be on them.
Have you noticed or done any research? Because I've noticed that it's like in my own practice that there seem to be a lot of young people that leave and go away to school and really have a hard time with that adjustment. Is that number growing or increasing as in sort of the snowplow parenting world, or is it kind of remaining the same as it was 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I look at my friend Julie Lithcott-Hame's work about how to raise an adult, and she has seen some of those challenges happen when she was a dean at Stanford. I worked at Northwestern when I was a graduate student there, and I then taught at Lake Forest College and at DePaul, and I also saw some 18 to 22-year-olds thrive and others struggle. Many of them thrived, and many of them struggled and thrived, and I think struggling can be on the path to thriving. You know, having a really rotten first year, struggling, being homesick, you know, struggling with roommates, all the sort of classic college stuff doesn't mean in the end it's not going to work out. I think our tolerance for our children's distress may have decreased. So we may be more worried. Like when we called and complained to our parents or we were miserable, maybe our parents didn't worry as much. They're like, whatever, they're miserable, but they'll survive. Or,
right,
you know, so there's some of that. There's some of like our ability to tolerate the distress. And there is some sense that, you know, the mental health is more concerning, that mental health resources on campus are more utilized and there's still not enough to go around. There's not enough therapists on campuses to support where kids are and young adults are right now. So I do think there's a mix of factors. I don't blame just parents. I don't think parents of teenagers need to hear more like, it's your fault. I mean, right. I think the pandemic certainly is an exacerbating factor right now, that kids missed some key milestones in high school and during those adolescent years of increasing independence. My own child was out of school for 18 months. His whole cohort was affected, right? Yeah. So I think it's really important to look at the role of the pandemic in this. It's important to look at the role of, you know, all of the issues that kids are facing, whether it's war, climate issues, right? The conversations around Me Too, the conversations around racial identity and surviving micro and macroaggressions based on race and ethnicity. I just think there's a lot we can be looking at when we look at kids and mental health. I don't think it's all parents' fault. That said, even parents of kids who haven't needed mental health support in high school, kids who didn't go to therapy or take meds or get any kind of mental health support in high school, still may end up needing mental health support as young adults. And more kids are going to college having already accessed supports in high school,
yeah,
frankly, more aware about mental health issues, you know. And so college is becoming more accessible, but are colleges supportive places? So I think all of those things are true. And I also will say professors are completely not equipped. I mean, I was trained as a professor, as a media historian. And if I had a student come to me about mental health, I only had my personal background mm-hmm. in mental health. Like I was given, you know, I taught at the college level until 2012. And at least until that time, we had no training in what to do if a student reports, for example, suicidality or anything like that. So I think that may have changed. It may be better, but I think you can expect that if your child talks to their RA or their professor, the answer is like, it might be helpful, but they might just refer them to counseling and they might get told there's a 6-month waiting list. And so that's just the reality of the situation. So every family should have kind of an emergency mental health plan, even if you think your kid's just fine. They probably are. They're probably gonna be great. The ups and downs, you know, might be totally average, but I would still have a mental health plan where they know who they can call if things get serious.
All right. Well, that's the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Dr. Heitner. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
All right. My thanks also to Line One producer Madeline Rose and to all of you for tuning in today. For all of us at Line One, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.